Tonight's presentation is called U.S. Relations with South Africa. And I want to add just a minute of a prelude to say that this is a subject which I'm not comfortable dealing with too quickly. I know that it is our habit as Americans, as soon as we get concerned about a given part of the world, to immediately want to do something in relation to that part of the world. But I think that too often we act before we know what we're talking about. With regard to Vietnam, for example, we looked at U.S. relations with Vietnam before we had ever really studied Vietnam. And I fear that we're making the same mistake in this country today by studying U.S. relations with South Africa. Some of you are familiar with the growing debate on U.S. campuses and in church bodies, particularly the Lutherans this year, about U.S. economic relations with South Africa. What I'm saying is I'm afraid that to debate an issue like that too quickly, before we really study South Africa, is to make controversial an issue which, if we were better informed, we would simply have no controversy about. And you take, for example, the Lutheran conventions that have been meeting the last few months and will continue to meet, and the national bodies, the LCA meeting in Seattle in a few weeks, and the ALC later this fall. In both those situations, you'll find that they're going to hotly debate whether or not they should be owning stock in corporations doing business in South Africa. And I think that that debate would fall flat on its face if we spent this year studying South Africa and then next year raised the question of whether or not, on the basis of what we know, do we want to be involved economically there. So for those of you for how many people is this your first session on South Africa this week? Raise your hand. Yeah, a number of you. This is the first exposure to South Africa you're getting. That's not necessarily your fault. I know a lot of new people came into the village today, and others have been busy for some of the other sessions this week. But let me just caution you that I think it's much more important to address this subject after we've looked into the situation as it exists in South Africa and some of the historical background. So if this is your first session, I hope you'll come back for more at some of the later sessions and get the background on what is the problem in South Africa. What is South Africa like? Why are we so concerned about it? And the best quick way I know to get that introduction is through the film that was shown last night, which we'll be showing again next week. So that apology aside, I want to look at our relations with a country that I'm concerned is not one that we ought to be associated with. I'm concerned that we are propping up in South Africa a minority regime representing whites who are only 20% of the population, and that this is contrary to a faithful relationship with the majority of the population in South Africa that is black. Now, there are three or four areas of U.S. relations that I want to focus on tonight. Two of them are common to many of you. How many people are familiar with the issue of bank loans to South Africa as a controversial issue and as a campaign that's being mounted in this country, particularly by some church bodies, to get U.S. banks to stop loaning to South Africa? A few of you are. How many are familiar with the campaign against investments, South African investments? Few more people are familiar with that. How many are familiar with the debate about arms traffic? Same hands keep going up. And finally, nuclear proliferation. Yeah. Okay, those are the four areas that we're going to look at. And I think there's more information out and about investments and bank loans, so we'll leave that to last and start off or look first at nuclear proliferation and illegal arms traffic. A good way to study the issue of helping South Africa become a nuclear power is in one of the films that we'll be seeing next week, or that I'll be showing in the village next week, called South Africa, the Nuclear File. And what I say this evening on that subject is just a brief summary of what will be covered in more depth in the film. United States cooperation with South Africa in the nuclear field began in the 1950s. Very early on in our own nuclear program, We needed access to uranium. Uranium, all of us are aware, is critical fuel for nuclear processing, for nuclear plants. And the U.S. needed uranium. There are some uranium deposits found in the Four Corners area of the Southwest on an Indian reservation, which we are cheating the Indians out of by mining and using for our nuclear industry, but it's nowhere nearly enough to feed the vastly growing nuclear industry. Canada is a major supplier of uranium, but in the 1950s, the United States made an agreement with South Africa, 1957, that for a 50-year period, from 1957 to the year 2007, South Africa would provide the United States with cheap uranium in exchange for the United States providing South Africa with nuclear technology. Now, the nuclear powers, the United States and the Soviet Union particularly, have drawn up a treaty called the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And the purpose of this treaty is to prevent countries from gaining nuclear bomb technology unless they promise not to spread that technology. In other words, the ideal is that a country should sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty before it is given nuclear technology. And in essence, what you do when you sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty is that you open up your nuclear plants to inspection by the International Atomic Energy IAEA, that's it, which is a UN-like body that inspects nuclear reprocessing plants to find out where is the you know, what's being done in these plants. Are they manufacturing highly enriched uranium to weapons grade in order to build bombs, or are they using this nuclear technology to create electricity, or what exactly is happening? And the idea is that a country should not get the technology until they promise to open up their plants to inspection to the international community. Well, in spite of the fact that South Africa has always refused to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the United States has provided South Africa, one, with a nuclear reactor. The firm Aulis Chalmers sold a nuclear reactor to South Africa, I think in the late 50s or the early 60s, somewhere in there, for a mere $4 million. If any of you are familiar with the costs involved in nuclear technology, you know that that was a steal. And two, the U.S. has also provided South Africa with computers to run its plants, two computers in particular. Because in the nuclear field, there's a difference between getting a reactor and getting uranium enrichment technology. Uranium enrichment technology is what you need to create the fuel to run the reactor. But you, in order to, if you have the reactor, what the U.S. did would give the reactor to South Africa and then tell South Africa, we're only going to give you small amounts of the fuel, and you need great amounts in order to build a bomb. We're only going to give you small amounts of the fuel until you sign the treaty. And once you've signed the treaty, then we'll know that your intentions are good, and at that point we'll start to sell you larger and larger amounts of the fuel. Well, the South Africans took what they could get, namely a reactor and small amounts of the fuel. They refused to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Then they went to West Germany and made a deal with West Germany in exchange for which they got uranium enrichment technology, so that South Africa completed the cycle necessary to make nuclear bombs, partly through U.S. help and partly through help from the West Germans. There's also been nuclear cooperation between South Africa and Israel in the way of a mutual exchange of scientists, and France and South Africa in the way of France supplying South Africa with the planes needed to carry nuclear warheads. So that South Africa today is a nuclear power in the world through a complex web of assistance from Western countries. But initially, it was the United States that began to supply South Africa with this nuclear technology.
Are you claiming that the South Africa has a nuclear weapon?
I'm claiming that South Africa has the technology and the capability of producing weapons. Now, whether or not, I believe that they last fall tested a nuclear device in South Africa or in the South Pacific. There was a scandal that mysterious twin flash that surfaced in our press in the winter. The evidence that I've seen of some investigative journalism done about that suggests that that was a test carried out mutually between South Africa and Israel in the region of South Africa, which has defied American detection processes precisely because in the 1950s, when the U.S. was in the early days of its own nuclear development program, as well as getting uranium from South Africa, what we also did was make an agreement with South Africa whereby we would test some of our own nuclear devices in the region of South Africa. There is a kind of anomaly. It's called the South African anomaly, which in the South Pacific, or no, in the Indian Ocean, somewhere between South Africa and Australia down there in the Indian Ocean, there is a spot where nuclear devices can be tested and the fallout somehow never manages to show up anywhere. It defies the laws of physics, but it happens. And the South Africans learned about this just as the Americans did, because the Americans, with South African cooperation, were testing their own devices. And at that time, South Africans gained access to a lot of information about fallout patterns when you test a device, so that they learned what happens when you test a device and in what ways is it possible to test these devices without really without it being detected that you are carrying out such an explosion. Now, in fact, there was some detection by satellite of a mysterious twin flash that occurred in that region last fall, and that has produced a lot of controversy. Now, people I've seen one excellent article on the subject by an investigative reporter that I respect a great deal. I'm afraid I don't have the article with me, and I just read it once, so I don't have it committed to memory as well as I'd like to. But his thesis was that basically this twin flash is not being pursued very avidly in Washington, because were it ever firmly established that either, let alone both, South Africa and Israel were experimenting with nuclear bombs, that would totally undermine American foreign policy in relation to both of those countries. That it would just be, we have a quote from a State Department official in this article, that it would be utterly disastrous for American foreign policy in relation to Israel and or South Africa were it ever established that either of those countries were experimenting with nuclear bombs. And with this strong suggestion that perhaps they are, apparently Washington believes it's better not confirmed, because that would just be tremendous embarrassment for President Carter and his whole policy in both the Middle East and Southern Africa. Because then clearly we would have undisputed proof that the South Africans were breaking their word in relation to a lot of agreements that they've made with us, and we would be obligated to cut relations that were up to our neck in at the moment, and that would be very difficult for politicians who have staked their entire careers on the appropriateness of these relations to have to backtrack and say, well, this was a mistake, particularly in relation to Israel. It's also possible that the West Germans were involved, because the West Germans, under their NATO contract, as is pointed out in the film that we'll see next week, the West Germans are obligated, according to their NATO contract, not to experiment with nuclear bomb technology on West German soil. This is because the other members of NATO so fear a rise in German militarism, again, that they have insisted that West Germany not get involved with developing nuclear bombs on West German soil. Now, West Germany is becoming rapidly catching up to the United States and becoming a competitor in the field of nuclear technology. They have developed their own process of uranium enrichment called the jet nozzle technique. And this is the technique, the type of uranium enrichment which is being used in South Africa today. And we have documents stolen from the South African embassy in Bonn, which undisputably indicate extensive illegal and undercover cooperation between the West Germans and South Africans to provide, for West Germany to provide South Africa with uranium enrichment technology in the form of this jet nozzle technique. Now, the question remains why, you know, it's obvious what South Africa had to gain in that kind of an exchange. And it's an open question what West Germany had to gain. And some people hypothesized that what West Germany had to gain was access to information about nuclear testing, which West Germany was not able to carry out on its own soil. The same is true for Israel. Israel obviously cannot start testing nuclear devices in Israel because that would be open to very quick detection, and the surrounding Arab countries would just go crazy over something like that. So both Israel and West Germany have a great deal to benefit by giving what they know about the nuclear field to South Africa in exchange for South Africa's acting as a place where these other two countries can experiment and gain the fruit of such experimentation. Now that goes beyond U.S. relations with South Africa and is part of wider Western relations. But I think in terms of the U.S. connection, it's important to remember that the U.S. supplied South Africa with its initial reactor, even though South Africa had not signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and the U.S. also supplied South Africa with the computers to run both its reactor, IBM, and also its uranium enrichment process. The Foxborough Corporation provided the latter. Check out the film for more information. And the film is based on a book called The Nuclear Axis, which we could spend a whole hour talking about the story of how that book got published, was expected to be a major world story at the point of its publication. All the syndication rights were very carefully sold up in one key media institution, the Sunday Times in London, which has a worldwide syndication network. They bought up all the rights. They were to take care of total distribution of the story. On the day that this book was published, it was to become a big international story that would go out around the world about called The Nuclear Axis, about how Western powers had provided South Africa with nuclear capability. And on the day of publication of the book, the Sunday Times, which had commissioned months prior to the date of publication, senior journalists who wrote major stories about the book, also hired investigators who checked out the authors and made sure that the book was accurate, even had some double-checked the investigations of the authors to make sure that their information was accurate. Had done all of this months prior to the date of publication of the book. And on the day of the publication, the editor of the Times called up the authors of the book and said, well, we decided not to run the story. By which time, by the time the authors of the book could recover and get somebody else to pick up the story, it was too late. It was a week old. And as we all know, our Western media are interested in instantaneous news, not week-old news. So the book has never really received much publicity. It has been well covered in Ireland and Scandinavia. It's had virtually no coverage in West Germany and very little coverage in the United States. So much for the nuclear field. That's one very important area of cooperation with South Africa. Those of you who saw the film last night know that white South Africans are an extremely desperate people. And what does it mean that these people have nuclear capability? And what are the implications of a state which is certainly going to become increasingly desperate in the next few years, being able to trade off nuclear technology or even weapons in exchange for diplomatic support. In other words, South Africa is a state which I believe will increasingly come under fire from the international community. And as it does so, it now, thanks to Western cooperation, is in the position of being able to blackmail the rest of the world by saying, if you continue to put heat on us, we in turn can create problems for you by selling nuclear bombs or nuclear technology to some countries that we might fear getting such technology. Anyway, I think people who really look into the whole field of nuclear technology know that if there's even one nuclear power in the world is very dangerous. But to spread that kind of technology and capability to other nations, particularly a nation as desperate as South Africa, makes chances for human survival much less. Okay, arms traffic. Virtually every American president since John Kennedy has in one form or another banned arms trade to South Africa. The logic has been that South Africa, being such an oppressive state, ought not be getting the benefit of American arms technology. And to varying degrees, every president, including Kennedy, has engaged in some kind of a boycott. In the fall of 1977, when Steve Biko was killed, and shortly after his death, his whole black consciousness movement, something I'll be talking more about next week, was banned in October, there arose at the United Nations a tremendous clamor for a total arms embargo, which is something that the United States and Great Britain had been vetoing in the Security Council for a number of years. But following the uproar of September and October of 1977, finally, all members of the Security Council went along with an arms embargo. And Carter announced in October of 77, October, November, something like that, a total arms embargo against South Africa. Announced that in no way would any American corporation in the future be allowed to continue sending arms or arms technology or even things that could be converted into military equipment, such as small airplanes or something like that. Even something which could be converted into equipment for military use was no longer, was just illegal from the United States now. Last February, the public television, public broadcasting system in this country aired a program called Hot Shells. Anybody see it? Anybody see that program? Yeah, a couple of you have. A transcript of the program is available. It was part of the World Series. And if you send $2 to WGBH Transcripts, 125 Western Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02134. You can get the address again afterwards if you're interested. Send them $2 and you get a transcript, which contains just about all the information that I'm going to say right now about this thing. It's very revealing about how about the double standards that exist in Washington. Not so much within the same branch of government, but among various branches of government. What this piece of investigative reporting does is to demonstrate that in spite of Carter's ban, the White House going along with a United Nations boycott of arms traffic to South Africa, in spite of that, there are people in the State Department and the CIA who believe that they know better and who believe that they are above the law of this country and who have decided that they would supply the South Africans with highly sophisticated armament technology. In particular, what most of the story is about the transfer of 155 millimeter howitzer shells. You see, in 1975, when the Angolan Civil War occurred, remember we talked earlier in the week about how South Africa, being at the very southern tip of the continent here, has always had a series of buffer states separating it from black Africa. And Angola was one of those buffer states here. In 1975, until 1975, Angola and Mozambique had been Portuguese colonies. And in 1975, the Portuguese pulled out and a civil war broke out in Angola for control of that territory. Now, the South Africans knew that it was important to them to have a government in power which would be friendly with them. So they backed one of the organizations in Angola, and the South Africans sent troops into Angola in order to fight that war. As a result of South African troops coming into Angola, the Soviet Union and the Cubans decided that, well, if the Western nations were going to send in troops and arms to fight on the side of one group in this civil war, then they in turn could do the same. The only difference was that whereas the CIA and the South Africans lied to the world community about their involvement in Angola. The Cubans went to the United Nations and made an open speech about it. And the Cubans were very honest and above board, and they said, look, we're going in because, and set out their reasons. Why? The Americans and the South Africans lied and said we're not there. But eventually, of course, it came out when South African soldiers were captured and put on display in Nigeria. It became very obvious that these were, in fact, just lies, and that there was South African involvement. The story of American involvement came out when the CIA officer in charge of Angolan operations, John Stockwell, wrote a book entitled In Search of Enemies and laid out for the public just exactly what the CIA's role in Angola had been. Now, anyway, got off the subject there. Sorry about that. The South Africans' experience in Angola was that they took a beating because of a certain kind of cannon that the Soviets had supplied to the group that the South Africans were fighting against. The Soviets had a very sophisticated 130-millimeter cannon shell, which was outdistancing any similar type cannon that the South Africans had. So the Soviets and the South Africans could position themselves out of range of South African artillery and still be able to shoot artillery at the South Africans. And this hurt the South Africans in their effort to participate in that war. So they decided that they better go shopping for some better technology, some better armament technology. And they came to the United States and made contact with an organization called Space Research Corporation. Now, Space Research Corporation is headed by a man named Dr. Jerry Bull, who is a Canadian citizen and runs a... I can get away with drawing maps of Southern Africa because you don't know what they look like, but I'm not going to try with the United States or I'll give away my bad map-making abilities. Space Research Corporation started out as a Canadian firm that was attempting to bring Canada into the space age by putting Canadian astronauts into space, so forth and so on. Jerry Bull, this was his project. He operated on a shoestring budget from an academic base, McGill University, for a while. He got the Canadian government to put in some money. And all the time, he claimed that all of his research and efforts were designed at providing a huge cannon that would be used not for military purposes, but would be used to shoot people into outer space. And he claimed that this cannon could shoot people to the moon if it had to. Now, initially the Canadian government went along with it, but pretty soon, the more and more money they put into it, the more time he had to experiment, the more obvious it became that he was not, in fact, dealing with non-military forms of technology at all, that what he was doing was developing armaments. And the Canadian government said, you know, we're not really interested in getting involved in this, so they pulled out. And at that point, Jerry Bull had to find somebody else that would assist him. He came to the United States and started working for the Pentagon. Now, in order for a foreign citizen to work in sensitive armaments technology in this country, it's necessary that that foreigner get American citizenship. And Jerry Bull, by a special act of Congress, which Barry Goldwater organized, Jerry Bull became an honorary American citizen in order that he could work with the Pentagon in the development of this technology. Now, Bull very conveniently made his headquarters for Space Research Corporation in a spot which straddles the Vermont-Canadian border. So that it's got, it's got one gate that leads to Canada, and it's got another gate that leads to Vermont. And that puts it in a very unique position as far as customs is concerned, because you can ship something in on the American side and out on the Canadian side, and you don't have to go through customs. The South Africans, when they decided to start hunting for special cannons that would outshoot the Canadian cannons, came to the United States and talked to a man named Jack Frost, who is a key consultant for the CIA on arms traffic, the CIA and a number of other foreign governments. And Jack Frost told the South Africans that they could probably find the kind of technology they wanted if they would get in touch with Jerry Bull at Space Research. And he was to act as the intermediary, but very quickly the South Africans told him, or so Frost claims, that they had decided against the sale. So Frost pulled out. Later he got word that the South Africans, in fact, had made a trip to Vermont to see Jerry Bull. And so Frost, getting scared now that he was going to, that in the future he could get implicated in what was illegal activity, because he knew he wasn't supposed to be selling arms technology to the South Africans or helping them get it in any way, he filed a report to the State Department, telling the State Department that this thing was going on, and alerting them to the fact that the South Africans were shopping in the United States for military technology, artillery shells. That report was never acted on in the State Department. And according to the investigation carried out in this World Report, two or three independent sources in the State Department have confirmed that Frost sent them the letter and have no explanation for why the State Department didn't follow up to stop this sale. Once the South Africans had made contact with Jerry Bull, what Bull did was go to the Pentagon, to a munitions plant in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and to order from them 50,000 155 millimeter shells, which are in effect the bombs that would be fired from this cannon. Then he went to another munitions plant, I don't remember where right now, and ordered six cannon that would be used to shoot these shells. Now, in any foreign transactions of shells, I mean, obviously now this was not an American order. Jerry Bull was not ordering these things for the Pentagon. He was a private arms manufacturer, and he was, so any time that American Army munitions plants are used to produce weapons for someone other than the Pentagon, there must be a letter directly from the government which is buying those weapons. And Jerry Bull had organized to buy some of these, some similar shells for the Israeli government at one point, and he had gotten a letter from the Israeli government to buy, I think it was 15,000 shells of a similar nature. And so when he made application for 50,000 shells, he put down that it was once again for Israel. And he never supplied them with a letter from the Israeli government to back this up, so that the munitions plant acted illegally by going ahead and manufacturing the shells, even though they didn't have a letter from the Israeli government to back up the fact that this was a request from the Israelis. Now, what Bull ordered from the Army was rough-hewn shells. In other words, it would be mainly the steel, I guess. I don't know that much about it, but it wasn't the finished product. It looked pretty much like a giant bullet, but it wasn't the final finished product. That would happen in the machine shops of Bull's operation in space research. And because it was only the rough product, Bull wrote to the State Department and said, I'm not asking for a special export license for these military shells, because my understanding is that unless the object is clearly recognizable as weapons, there is no need to have such a special export license. And the State Department wrote back and said, your interpretation is correct, as long as it doesn't look clearly like weapons. Then the TV program switches to the man who carried, to the director of the munitions plant, and says, could these things be used for anything other than military purposes? And the guy says, well, I guess you could use them as a boat anchor or a fence post, but as far as I know, about the only thing they're good for is artillery shells. And then they switched to the guy who drove the trucks that transported the shells from Scranton, Pennsylvania to Vermont. And the guy says, well, it was obvious. They looked like big bullets. Then they switched to another truck driver who carried the cannon from another munitions plant. And they say, what did they tell you these cannon were? And the guy says, well, they said that they were shock tubes. And the narrator says, well, what do you think they meant by shock tubes? And the guy says, well, I suppose they meant that if you stood on the one end of it and fired the other end, you'd get a hell of a shock. They went in on the Vermont side, came out on the Canadian side, were loaded on the a ship called the Tugela-Land. Now, the Tugela-Land is, in fact, a ship, a South African ship, which, under complicated leasing arrangements, flies under the West German flag with the West German crew, so that anyone who was directly dealing with the ship in the port where it was loading its weapons would get the impression that they were dealing with German businessmen, and they wouldn't become suspicious by the fact that this was a South African. And the papers identifying the true owners of the ship were tucked away in Cape Town, far away from the prying eyes of U.S. customs officials. The Tugela-Land picked up these shells and cannon and took them to the Caribbean, to a small island called Antigua, where there is a small dictator. And Jerry Bull went to Antigua and made a deal with the president of Antigua, and promised the president of Antigua that in exchange for a little piece of land where he could have a testing site, he called it, he promised to pay for and train a private army for this dictator, so that if the dictator ever had any problem with left-wingers or trade unionists, then he would have an army that Jerry Bull was prepared to pay for and train. And the president of Antigua said, okay, made the deal, and they set up a little testing range, which in fact was never really used. Local residents say that one or two shots would be fired in the morning, and that was about it. Yet 50,000 shells were shipped to Antigua. They were shipped on board this the ship. They were unloaded at the dock. They were never taken from the dock to the test site. Instead, a few weeks after they arrived, another boat came and picked them up again. So they were brought down by one boat, put on the dock. Another boat comes to town, takes them off the dock, and this boat claims, according to its shipping papers, it's headed back for Canada. Now they go and they interview the shipping agent and they in Antigua, and they say, you know, where did this cargo come from? The guy says, Canada. Did it ever leave the dock? No. Where was it supposed to be going to? Supposed to be going back to Canada. Don't you think this is kind of strange? And the guy says, yeah. And the narrator says, well, would you be surprised to hear that this boat, when it left Antigua, instead of sailing for Canada, headed straight to Cape Town. A few months later, the South Africans announced that, quite apart from any help from anyone else in the world, they had developed in record time a brand new cannon technology. The story goes on to show how space research, as well as providing the artillery shells and the cannon, also shipped via South African Airways from New York City, a great deal of very sophisticated electronic equipment. It is also rumored, but not confirmed at this point, that some components which could have been used in testing the nuclear device that was exploded in the region of South Africa last fall that we talked about earlier. Some of that is rumored to have come from Space Research Corporation in Vermont. And Space Research also, this is verified, supplied, along with the cannon and artillery shells, a number of ballistic experts who went to South Africa shortly after the shells were delivered and conducted various tests, so that the South Africans would not only get the equipment, but would also get the benefit of the technology. I mean, it's one thing for the corporation just to sell the equipment to South Africa, in which case, if South Africa wants any more of that product, they've got to come back to the U.S. and buy it all over again. But apparently what Space Research did was, as well as providing the initial equipment to work with, they also sent down the scientists and the ballistics engineers who helped the South Africans understand the whole technology involved. And in a newspaper that I get published by the South African government, a most recent issue which arrived in the village yesterday, on the front page, there's a new story that South Africa announces a fancy new 127-millimeter cannon, which they claim they've developed all on their own, which they feel will outshoot the Russian equivalent of 130 millimeter, which is what battered them so badly in the Angolan Civil War. And the front page report says the Minister of Defense, or the Prime Minister, who was the former Minister of Defense, is still the Minister of Defense, in fact, announces that this technology will be available for sale to appropriate governments. Thanks to the United States, so proud of itself for finally going along with the UN embargo against armament technology sales to South Africa. And this is not an isolated case. When the Angolan and Mozambican civil wars were going on, the wars for independence between 60 and 75, the official policy of the State Department was to support majority rule in Angola and Mozambique. In other words, the official policy of our government on paper was we support the right of the majority of the people in those countries to govern themselves. However, Portugal, which was the colonial power that the majority of the blacks were fighting against, happens to be an ally of the United States. And Portugal happens to control the Azores, which is an important military installation that the United States leases from the Portuguese and uses for our benefit. And the lease on the Azores came up during the War of Independence in Angola and Mozambique, and the Portuguese said, we're only going to renew your lease if you will sell us the military equipment that we need to fight the war against the people that our State Department claimed we supported. Most of us know enough about the capitalistic system to know that if you want to make money, you usually have to take out a loan and invest some capital in a project. And South Africa, being a rapidly industrializing country, I've mentioned to, for some of you who for whom this is your first session, South Africa is not your typical developing African nation. South Africa is a highly industrialized state. In some fields of technology, the South Africans are more advanced than the United States. Highly industrialized, highly sophisticated technological nation. And part of the process of becoming so industrialized has required great amounts of foreign capital. And much of this capital has come from banks in the United States. Well, the World Council of Churches, I think 1972, announced that it was embarking on a campaign to lobby Western banks to stop loaning money to the South African government and to South African companies, which were creating this industrialized nation, which was keeping the majority of the black people down. In other words, the position of the World Council of Churches was, South Africa is such a bad state, better words escape me at the moment, that we ought not be using our money to fund the development of this kind of a nation. And so the World Council of Churches in 72 kicked off this campaign. It took quite a while for it to take root in the United States, but in the last few years, increasingly, under leadership from the Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility, which is housed at 475 Riverside Drive in New York, which is the building of the National Council of Churches and a number of other major church denominations in this country, they have a computer and they've been monitoring which banks loan money, and they've started a campaign to get Americans to pull their money out of banks that loan money to South Africa unless those banks sign statements promising not to engage in further loans. In the Northwest, it's Rainier and SeaFirst, primarily, who loan money to the South African government or to other corporations that operate in South Africa. And there is this growing campaign which says, we don't want our money being used to fund such an immoral and oppressive government that we think ultimately is going to be revolted against anyway, and rightfully so, and we would like to be able to have good relations with the new government that comes to power there. So we want to cut off our support for the old one. I think that those of you who are from Seattle, I think you will find that this campaign, which has been very slow moving, for reasons I'm very cynical about, is finally going to make some progress this fall, and I think you will have, we'll see a major a week of actions take place, maybe late October, early November this fall, where there will be a public campaign waged to urge people who have their accounts in churches, which have their accounts in SeaFirst or Rainier, to, on one day of collective withdrawal, to demonstrate our abhorrence of support for apartheid in South Africa and to ask you to withdraw your accounts. And when you see that information, I hope you will think seriously about it. Investments. There are 350 American corporations that maintain facilities in South Africa, a number of others that do business with South Africa. And the National Council of Churches, through the Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility, has been waging a campaign to get Americans who hold investments in those institutions to sell off their stock in businesses that do business in South Africa, unless the corporation is willing to pull out of South Africa. Most, if not all, the Lutheran bodies in the country this year are facing resolutions at their conventions which call for us to engage in this, because the 350 corporations doing business in South Africa include most of the largest. A few years ago, South Africa returned to American investors an average annual rate of return on our investment of 19%. Now, that's a very, very high average annual rate of return. In fact, that year there was none other in the world, no other national average that was that high. You can make a higher percentage off of a given company, but to take all of the foreign companies invested in a given country and to take their average annual rate of return, that year there was none higher than 19%, one of the most profitable places in the world to invest, because as we talked about last night, workers in South Africa, black workers, are required by law to hold the low-ranking positions. For those of you who weren't here and don't know South Africa, the government of South Africa says that if you're white, you have to hold certain jobs, and if you're black, you have to hold other jobs. In other words, all jobs are classified according to race, and it just works out that all of the best paying jobs and the highest level jobs, the management jobs, are reserved by law for whites. Furthermore, blacks have no trade union rights in South Africa. Well, now they're beginning to get some trade union rights. I'm very cynical about them. A friend of mine is a trade union expert in South Africa, a white who was invited by our State Department to come to the States last fall, and the South African government refused to give him a visa because right now it's engaged in a campaign to convince Westerners that it is beginning to give trade union rights to South Africans, and they didn't want somebody who was a specialist on black trade unions to come to this country and to help us understand what in fact is happening. So they sent to the United States a number of trade unionists who are very carefully under government control, and they let them talk about how this is a sign of change, but other trade union experts who would have talked critically were refused from coming to this country and weren't necessarily radicals. The State Department does not invite radicals to come and tour this country at its expense. Although my friend Johan might argue with me about whether or not he's a radical, but he's not. He's white. So, no trade union rights, or very little in the way of trade union rights, and this job reservation system, which creates high profits. Also, the system of migrant labor that we talked about last night. All adds up to high profits for American corporations. And this means that financial people who manage pension funds for the Lutheran Church, or who manage investment portfolios for Lutheran seminaries or Lutheran universities, or who manage the investment portfolio of the bureaucracies of the Lutheran Church that take some of their funding to pay the salaries of our district presidents, or our not district, our synod, or denominational staff. Not all of that comes out of our pocket. A lot of that money comes out of profits made off of investments in other parts of the world. And a lot of those investments, because financial people, it's their business to invest where they can make money, have been attracted by the possibilities of making money in South Africa. And a lot of our money is invested in South Africa. And there is a move underway in the Lutheran bodies this year to ask Lutherans, for us as Lutherans, to commit ourselves to pulling our investments out of those parts of the world. Of Southern Africa, out of those companies that are doing business in South Africa and that refuse to leave South Africa.
David, I was at the Concordia Convention 2 years ago at one of the mini group meetings one night that was the discussion of the investments. I think Paul Lee was there that night. And there was quite a hot debate, and it went on and on. And they came to the conclusion that night, and what happened at the convention, I don't know, because I didn't mean to that. But they decided it was better for our investors to keep the money there and be part of the stockholders of these companies so that they'd have some regulation and some control than to pull out and not be able to help. Now, what has happened since that?
Yeah. Great. The argument is that the argument that the corporations are putting up, and that a lot of financial people who manage, I mean, people like George Shultz of the ALC who are involved in managing the funds, their argument is that if we pull out of South Africa, a couple of things are going to happen. A, the first people who suffer are going to be blacks who lose their jobs. Because if an American corporation pulls out, then that's the loss of jobs. And so we don't want to hurt the black people by causing a rise in unemployment. So we ought to stay. And B, or two, that if we pull out, we no longer have any leverage to use against the South African government. That we're better off staying there and using our influence in the country to try and encourage change, to work for change. Now, this is the argument in a very powerful, very seductive argument which is being used. And it is exactly what I mean when I say that it's very dangerous to study U.S. relations with South Africa before we study what South Africa is all about. I don't think that such arguments would hold up if we knew more about the South African scene. For example, Steve Biko, who was dead before most Americans even knew his name and who had a lot to say to us, pointed out that if American corporations, it was his opinion that the only way short of war that Americans could help blacks come to power in South Africa was through an economic boycott. He said the only non-military method possible of changing the South African government as a result of our history. Now, you can argue with him unless you know the history. If you know the history, it's very difficult to argue with this conclusion, because the history of blacks trying to come to power in South Africa is not something that started 5 or 10 or 20 or 40 years ago. They formed an organization in 1912 that was committed to legal, peaceful negotiation, and have had a long history since then of being shot down for peaceful protests, and have now come to the conclusion that the only alternative left are two: either an economic boycott that the West would have to inaugurate, or secondly, guerrilla warfare. Secondly, Biko says, if you choose an economic boycott, that is going to hurt some black workers. Not too many, because for the most part, American investments in South Africa are capital intensive, not labor intensive, which means that American companies don't hire that many blacks in the first place. But even if they did, and those blacks lost their jobs, at least we would be suffering with some hope, which is an improvement on the way we're suffering at the moment, and is certainly a preferable method to suffering than having to take up arms. We would rather suffer from a loss of job than suffer from having to pick up guns. Now, that's an example of I think, a very powerful counter to the argument raised by American financial people. But because we live among American financial people, and our first approach is to study U.S. relations instead of studying the South African scene, we never learn about who the Steve Bikos are, and we never get their voice or their contribution to an argument like this, and we are eventually seduced by arguments among our own people about how we could try and use American power to help other people.
The argument that I've heard that it's made at church conventions is, yes, the corporations should pull out of South Africa, but the most effective way that the church can move towards getting the corporations to pull out is not by divesting of our shares in that stock, but holding on to them and then trying to introduce shareholder resolutions. What do you think of that one?
Clearly, if an American corporation pulls out of South Africa, that delivers a very strong message to the South Africans.
Yeah,
it hurts them.
If
they choose instead to work for a change within the corporation, the experience of groups that have done this over the last several years, and the Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility is coordinating this process, is that shareholders' resolutions are raised at the annual stockholders' meetings, And I know of not a single resolution that has gotten higher than a 5% vote. Because basically people own stock to make money. And the churches that own a little stock in a corporation own a very tiny percentage of that corporation's stock. And a church may consider itself as having some moral obligations, but don't kid yourself. Most of the people who own stock in a corporation go to that annual stockholders meetings, and the chairman of the board stands up and they says, our financial analysts have looked at every resolution before us. They have told us which ones are going to make us money, which ones are going to cost us money, and we suggest you vote for the ones that make money. People own stock in order to get profit, and they vote to make profit. I'd be a little bit more encouraged by that argument if it was drawing, 40, 45, 49% of the vote, which would, get it near the point where it was going to start having some impact.
How do you know that, David?
From the stockholders' resolutions that I've seen. I know of none that has come anywhere near passing.
And you don't think the corporations are sensitive to a witness of even, say, a 5% vote on a resolution or something have changed a little bit because of that?
Our own Lutheran Brotherhood representatives, when I asked where are you investing your money, they said our first thing is to make sure that the people who invest with us make the best return on their investment. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're in business for.
And they believe that that's right because they say once we get this money, then we'll use it for good purposes. So it doesn't much matter how we get it, because in the end we're going to use the money for moral purposes. Lutheran Brotherhood, where does the money of Lutheran Brotherhood go? It doesn't go to South Africa. It goes right into our own pockets. It pays for our education. It does a lot of nice things for us. But it comes from South Africa and it stays here in the U.S. The rationale that Steve Biko offered is echoed by Manus Buthelezi, a Lutheran bishop and theologian in South Africa. Asked the question, what is the black community's response to international calls for sanctions? He replied, there's no doubt that if South Africa suffers, the black people will suffer as well. But we must remember that even when a country goes to war, it does so knowing that some of its citizens are going to die in the process. The same thing applies here. We know that there will be suffering, but we realize that it is by suffering that something better may happen. We don't mind taking the consequences. Now, he didn't come right out and call for divestment because it's against the law in South Africa. You can go to jail. And recently some church leaders were charged with this crime of calling for divestment. And 53 church leaders are going to be prosecuted in the near future for sticking their neck out by asking foreign corporations to pull their money out of South Africa.